This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Today, we are recording episode 205, and I'm happy to report that we're doing well. The numbers are in. The audience is growing. We have about 2 million views over the past 7 days, and the download numbers are in as well. We're averaging about 150,000 downloads now every few months. This is good. That's all contributed to the audience, to the followers of this channel. I appreciate you being with me on this journey of 2.5 years. My guest today started her career as a financial translator, somewhere between building a 40-person team at SDL and cross 55 source languages and landing at Aclaro. She became one of the industry's most thoughtful voices in what it actually means to localize for culture and not just language. Now she's asking a question that I think keeps a lot of global marketers up at night. In an era where AI is generating content at scale, who's watching out for the cultural signal that machine are trained to miss? Her answer starts with something called cultural intelligence, and I will get to know a little bit about cultural intelligence a little bit with the discussion with my guest today. And she's here to unpack what it means in practice. Melissa McMahon, welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat. Pleasure to have you with me.
Thank you, Robin. Really happy to be here.
I appreciate your time. For the audience, Melissa McMahon is a VP of Services, Language Services at Aclaro Localization and Cultural Intelligence and AI Company. As we say on this channel, Mel, if you don't mind me calling you Mel, if that's okay with you.
Yep.
Mel, we say everybody's got a story. And, you know, I've told my story a million times on this channel, but what's your story? What got you here?
So I think mine started with a love of languages. I was probably 7 years old, and I remember my grandpa teaching me the first French word and teaching me about logic in language. And it was the word souvenir. And he said, you know, you think about, you go on vacation and you come back with a memento. And the French verb to remember is souvenir. And I thought, oh, wow. Love the idea of that logic in language. And then I went to a French school for a couple of years in the UK, which of course built on that. So I guess inevitably I ended up studying languages at university, nothing too exotic, French and German. And I got to the end of my degree, Robin, and I was kind of embarrassed because I could do 17th century literature, I could discourse on art imitating life, but I couldn't actually hold a conversation with a human. So I decided to move to Germany and thought I'd go for a year. That would be enough to give me some colloquial German. And I ended up staying for 4 years. I absolutely loved it. Loved being immersed in a different culture, and every day was a learning experience. And I kind of knew even when I was at university that I'd like to do translation, but I was eager to start work. I didn't want to do more study. And so after my 4 year undergraduate studies, I went straight into employment. And I actually went in through project management. I worked for a subsidiary of Hitachi while I was in Germany. And then I ended up, when I moved back to London, I was desperate to work in the kind of whole investment banking scene. I had lots of friends in that area. But I knew I was never mathematically minded enough to be a dealer or a broker. So I landed a job, which was a dream job in mergers and acquisitions. And this is early 90s, mid-90s probably by this stage, largely pre-internet. And so I would come into work every morning to a stack of European newspapers on my desk. And this was at the height of all of the mergers in Germany. So ThyssenKrupp, Mannesmann and Vodafone, Daimler and Chrysler. And my job was to trawl through the papers and find any information on any of the mergers, anything to do with the Monopolies Commission, and translate that. So it was my first proper job translating, and I was completely fixed. Loved it. Moved on then to EVS, who subsequently got bought by Unbabel, and really kind of honed my craft there as a financial translator. And then I moved from there after about 4 years to SDL. And that was quite, and I went in as a translator. I went in as a senior financial translator at that stage. And I can remember at the time, the training they did in your first couple of weeks for the induction and onboarding kind of opened my eyes to localization rather than translation. And there's one, it's 20 odd years ago, so I don't remember everything from the training, but they had the Disney character, McScrooge, Scrooge McDuck, that's got the dollar signs in his eyes.
That's right,
and the
yeah.
Question, the question was, would you localize this in another market? If you were going into Japan, would he have a yen sign? I was like, wow, in financial translation, this doesn't come into it. It was very dry, very kind of formulaic. And suddenly it was like, oh, this is a whole exciting new area. So that was probably one of my first times that I really started to think about the cultural impact about what we're doing. And I stayed at SDL for, obviously now RWS, 16 years. In a number of incarnations. I didn't stay in translation for long. After a year, I founded their Into English translation office. And then I ran that for about 5 years. And I was really blessed. I had a number of different roles within the organization. So I was director of intelligent machine translation. So at the time that we were operationalizing machine translation post-edit, so pushing that out across the production offices, I took over supply chain, so vendor management for a couple of years. I moved into the transformation team, and then I ended up, before I left there and came to Claro, in the language cloud area as a product manager. So I was very lucky that I had a lot of opportunities to see the business from different angles. So the supply chain brings its own complexities, but obviously in the English language office, big focus on the production and the quality. And then happily, Claro and my role here actually takes all of those and brings those all together. So I oversee production, quality, what we call community management, but the resourcing side of it. So it's been a really nice kind of move to pull together those different strands and to oversee the language services side here at Claro.
Well, very fascinating, Mel. But, you know, just for the audience, and as I was doing the research on you, you lived in multiple countries, and now you literally work on the land in Wales. I don't know how that adds up, but I'm going to let you just explain that. How does where you live shape how you think about language and culture at work?
Yeah, so we live in an absolutely beautiful spot. We moved here about 5-6 years ago. Very rural, so can't see the nearest neighbours from my office window that I'm looking out of. And where we are in Wales, it's predominantly English speaking. My stepson is actually, well, he is bilingual, but Welsh is his first language. So if ever he and his father wanted to discuss something without me getting wind of it, they could happily jump into Welsh. And he speaks Welsh primarily with his on his mother's side of the family. But now I love one of the things I love here, although it's a kind of, and it depends which part of Wales, you know, some pockets are a lot more Welsh speaking, some more English speaking. But I like how they, Welsh is always first. So if you see a road sign or, you know, a stop sign on the road, Welsh always comes first and then English second, even in the areas where English is predominant. And I guess this was quite a different pace of life for me. So I've lived in London. As you say, I've lived in Germany. I spent a year in Greece as well. And this is very different. We've got a small holding. So at the end of the day, my downtime and my switch off is working, you know, going out and checking on the animals and feeding them. Just coming out the end of lambing season, the last lambs were born on Tuesday. So it's a very nice antidote, if you like, to the working life. But one of the things, and I'm sure this comes with age, I'm sure other people will resonate. I look back and think, how did I assimilate French and German so easily at a younger age? And I've lived here 5-6 years now, and my vocabulary and my understanding is embarrassingly small. The only time it resonates is if there's a word that's similar to French, and suddenly that's the one that gets embedded in my memory. And my mother's completely constantly going, but you were a linguist. How are you not fluent already? And I'm sure it's an age thing. That's what I'm putting it down to. But that's a whole different dynamic. It's a very different language. And kind of hearing a language that you haven't learned, that's quite different. Culturally, not massively different. Very, very friendly nation. But then I wouldn't necessarily say people in the UK aren't. So not a huge cultural shift, I would say. But a nice flavor or dynamic, perhaps.
You know, when I was reading this, and I've interviewed, you know, as you can tell, over 200 individuals on this channel, I never gotten to the part where the story leads to living on the land, caring for farm animals, etc. And I'm learning something new today. You know, lambing season. That's the first time I'm hearing this term.
Yeah, it's never a dull moment. It's quite a running joke with my team that sometimes there'll be a bird pecking on the window. I've got peacocks, so there'll be a peacock sitting on the window, or they'll say, "What's that noise in the background?" And yeah, so yeah, definitely always something happening.
Back to language, CQ, for those who are listening, CQ stands for, in this case, cultural intelligence. The ability to align content, campaigns, and digital experiences with local expectations from a value and from a behavior as well in some cases. For listeners who haven't heard the term before, how do you explain cultural intelligence in plain language, Mel?
I think I've always been very big on emotional intelligence. I think, you know, I'm a very much a people person. And I think that ability to read emotions and respond accordingly is really key. And I think cultural intelligence isn't disconnected from that, but it goes beyond the individual and the emotions, and it's the cultural resonance. So how do we take the words we're using, the text that we're producing, the images that we're producing, and make sure that they're culturally appropriate, make sure that they resonate with the audience, make sure that they're going to evoke the right responses in the audience that we're looking for, and that there's no harm done. And I think it's that, emotional intelligence is kind of global. Whereas for me, the cultural, it's the subtleties in the culture. It could be an image, it could be a metaphor, it could be a colloquialism, it could be a color that, you know, resonates one way in one particular pocket of the world and is seen. What if you take white, for example, if we think it's very so from where I'm sitting, it's pure and it's, you know, brides wear white, it symbolizes the start of something new, it's a very pure color. But in other cultures, some Asian cultures, it's the color used in mourning and in death. And so even on those kind of levels, it's thinking about how will the message that I'm trying to give land in different places, and what are the risks there that I need to be aware of that I can then attempt to mitigate as best possible.
You know, I had a conversation with on this podcast with a guest from Pakistan. I think he is in Pakistan, and he's a lead translator for Urdu in that region. And we discussed something similar to what you were just mentioning, Mel, around, for instance, the mobile devices in that region are widely used in English. The technology has not yet localized it into their local language in the way that local language can be used in those instances. So, which leads me to a question to you, if you don't mind now. Do we meet these cultures that you're talking about from an intelligent perspective where they are, or are we trying to modify or up, I don't know how you want to characterize this, or up the standard of that culture to what global companies want to do?
It's a good question, actually. There's probably different levels. Like at some levels, and particularly with high volume content, I think you almost need to pitch it as a kind of one size fits all. Maybe support content, for example, or call center scripts. If you think of the volume required there, if you were then to kind of localize those per territory, per country, per language, per dialect, that's going to get really exhaustive, really expensive. It probably comes down as well to what's the risk? So I think, and this partly comes down to an educational thing as well, and I'm sure we'll talk more about, you know, educating the people creating the content, but also educating the end user. I think at the other end of the scale, you've absolutely got a need to make that content culturally relevant for the territory. You know, if you think, and I think the reason why it's become more prevalent through AI is previously, if we were doing, let's say, a marketing campaign, you would have one translator doing that for each language. So if that one translator wasn't culturally sensitive and used the wrong imagery or language or tone, that kind of impact is more limited. Whereas if AI struggles, if it's struggling, and I'm sure that's something we'll debate, is it, isn't it? If it was struggling, the potential impact would be across all languages and would be huge. So it's almost like having a dial and being able to kind of choose and say, okay, the impact on this particular content, maybe it's, I don't know, reviews or something like host reviews, is going to be less dramatic than if this is a marketing campaign or even training material. That's a good example, you know, training users. We're there, you want people to not only understand it, but to get on board with it, to embrace that, and to be able to then personify it when they take that out to their customers. There it's more important. So, you know, funds aren't finite. Companies can't localize everything for every language, every market. They've got to really think, where have I got the biggest risk? Where is it going to do the biggest damage if I'm not conscious of this, versus where can I take that risk? And there's a lot of decision making involved in this.
100%.
Being conscious of it and then having, you know, the authority and the confidence to be able to even say, stop, that's not going to publication. There's too much of a risk associated.
You know, where I've seen this manifest quite obvious is when Global companies are trying to understand how their consumers are either interacting with their product and services by doing surveys. So when you launch a consumer survey across multiple countries and you don't localize these surveys to the local country, you're going to end up with the wrong data. You're going to end up with ramification of that downstream is unbelievable because you're going to end up developing wrong products, wrong services, not aligning with the culture that you're trying to sell to. I'm amazed how sometimes, you know, not localizing, which costs a little tiny money in comparison to the development cost of a product or service. People skip that because it's just we know what they need. No, you don't. You haven't asked.
Yeah.
Appropriately.
Yeah.
For instance, example for the audience I've used before is that when you use salary bracket in a survey and use salary brackets in the Western world and apply that to a country that probably their salaries are counted in few dollars a month, you're going to throw everybody's off and you're not going to be able to get right data out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. Yeah.
Now, in your world, most localization buyers right now still think translation when they hire an LSP. At what point in a project do you realize are there confusing language and culture?
We tend to, I have a great team of, the exact title is account quality managers. Language leads is a role within that group. And these guys really act as our consultants. They're the kind of guardrail, if you like, to make sure that we're on track. Now, in everything, I think quality begins at source. I think you can try and deal with quality issues downstream and try and correct them retroactively. But if you get it right at the beginning, you're going to save yourself a lot of pain, a lot of cost, a lot of time lost. And so we tend to look right at the start, do a source analysis. And I think one of the key things in it, Robin, is thinking about the target audience and actually partnering with the customer to help them understand this isn't just a like-for-like translation. This is actually, you know, making sure that's culturally, not even culturally sensitive, but sensitive to the market. So that could be, what's the tone of voice? Do you want formal? Do you want informal? What is the kind of demographic that you're going after? Do you want direct or indirect speech? Now, they may not know. Sometimes when we start to raise these things, you can see the customers kind of looking a little blank, thinking that's not anything I've really thought about. And that's where we come in to kind of handhold throughout that. And I think having the style guides that help govern that, that you can then use as part of a training day to set a key. So I think, you know, I feel very sorry for translators because sometimes we kind of give them so much reference material to look at. You look at linguistic instruction, style guides. We've still got translation memories. We've got the term bases. But it's so important because perhaps that one little line that says, we're after a formal tone of voice. Now, what if historically the customers use an informal tone? Because they may well have a change, right? Or they may have completely, you know, decided to have a rebrand, a refresh. If we're not attuned to that, we're going to go very off kilter. And so I think it's, you know, there's a lot the translators need to check before they get started. And so I don't think nowadays anybody's doing pure translation. Everything to some degree is transcreation. And I think with AI, you know, we've always kind of done hypercare on marketing projects, right? You know, if it's marketing or transcreation, copywriting, they're in their own area where you've got a really heavy process involved, maybe multiple people, maybe even a kind of powwow of throwing slogans around and approaches. But it was the sort of impact that cultural insensitivity could have was more limited to that area. Whereas now I think it can mess things up on UI. It can mess things up in documentation. It can mess things up in training material if you don't get it right at source. So I think it has to start really early in the conversation and helping to educate people on what the impact could be, you know, the brand impact, the alienating buyers, you know, it can impact uptake. It can impact sales rates. It can impact relationships. I mean, it can be very far reaching. It's really early in the process, but it doesn't stop. I think it's something that's constantly monitoring right through to the end and even after delivery as well, in terms of them monitoring how things land and what the feedback is. Obviously, if you've not caught it early enough, that's not great if you're catching things at the end and then you've got to kind of backtrack. But yeah, getting it right at the start, I think. And I don't think we can expect customers to always think on that level, right? They're busy building the product or developing the service. That's where we need to come in as the kind of subject matter experts and say, if you haven't thought of these things, let's work together. Let's think through together how you want this to land. There was a good example. I was talking one of our account quality managers in Italy, and we were talking about the difference between US and UK English source. And if you think like of a call to action, and US tends to be a little more punchy, a little more colloquial, like, hey, now let's click here. And this
more in your face. Say,
oh, exactly. And she said, oh, this is just so, this is not right for an Italian audience. It's not, it feels very infantile. It feels very patronizing. It wouldn't make me click there. It needs to be a lot more serious and a little less whoop whoop and just a lot more dry and factual. And so again, that might land differently with different people. And I think, you know, it's helping customers be conscious of that, but also not scaring them and say, but don't worry, because we can take care of that. You don't need to think about it there. Give us the source, guide us on who your audience are. Let us then do the kind of the steps to get you to the right end result.
Mel, do you think, you know, based on what you just saying, do you think are we in an era where we're going to judge translation based on the content outcome? What are we trying to do with this content at the end of the day? Is it successful after we did the transformation to another language, yes or no? And how do we measure success to that? Is this where we are right now, or do you think?
I absolutely think we're heading there. I think it's going to be less about the deliverable, the actual linguistic deliverable, and more how it resonates, how it lands. Does it result in more click-throughs? Does it result in more sales? Did you manage to hire the right people for the job if it was a localized job advert? I absolutely do. And I think we're going to get into that phase very quickly, where that's the KPIs and the metrics for success that companies care about. I think, we're still to some degree stuck in the world of doing, a kind of linguistic quality assessment at the end and using, you know, our traditional scores to evaluate the language quality. But I think it's bigger and wider than that now. It's not just the linguistic quality. It's that kind of governance layer. And it's the, what is the reaction? So, you know, a customer is going to think, okay, great. I localized that into 10 languages. So what? So what? What would have happened if I'd only put that material out in English? Would I have expected the same response rates? And so I think that analytics is going to be really important. You know, these customers have got to, you know, they're going to be going and asking for the funds to localize the next product. They need to be able to show, because we did it this way, because we adapted for the market, this is what we saw versus the last campaign, we saw this. Here's the delta. It's worth the investment. I absolutely think you're spot on, Robin. I think that's what it's going to be about. What was the impact from what we did, not what was the actual deliverable on paper?
You know, almost 26 years in the industry, and one of the things that still baffle me is we don't make enough case as an industry to why a company needs to translate beyond being nice to another culture. There is a business reason why you need to translate. We have not yet quantified that and put it right up front in any conversation that we're having in this industry. You translate, you spend money on translation because there's an ROI for that, because it impacts your business positively. And we need to quantify that a lot more and do a lot more research and analysis on why a company A in a company B, and you just maybe do a comparison, company A who translated to their market, here's what happened, and a company B who ignored it. And there's many examples in life. I mean, I can remember when I first started in the language industry 26 years ago, people used to tell me, like, I don't want to name any names right now. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But if you are not speaking English, you cannot buy our product. That was well-known fact. And I'm not saying anything here to upset anybody. 26 years ago, that was the go-to statement if a high-tech company is trying to sell the product into a country where they don't speak the language. That was a statement being used. Today, most products are being developed, most services are being developed for the local, for the global region first, and then for the local region. Because most of these startups are eyeing, you know, the unicorn, and the unicorn is not going to come from your local region. Now, let's talk a little bit about AI, Mel, if you don't mind. So AI can produce thousands of pieces, and I think we're in an era right now. You mentioned it earlier, like the content, the source content is questionable. So let's get into it. So it feels to me right now we're into robot to robot kind of a discussion. You know, you've got AI creating content and you've got LSP using AI to treat this content as a first step, I guess, and there's a human involved in the process. But let's imagine a world where you've got AI versus AI, and that's the starting point. And in a lot of cases, these AI can generate thousands of pieces in localized content before a human reviewer can even blink. I mean, press of a button and these things are out. What is the worst case scenario from a CQ perspective when that step is missing in that pipeline. What is the ramification, you think?
I think part of the thing with AI is because it sounds so fluent, you look at it at face value, and we all, not all, some of us a little bit more skeptic, but a lot of people trust it blindly. We're kind of won over by the fluency and ignore any hallucinations, or perhaps even aren't conscious of them. And so I think there's a real danger. And I think it is happening. It's why, in many instances, humans are being cut out of the loop, because somebody who's perhaps not into that subtle layer of what's the sub-message, at face value says, this looks great. You go ahead and publish with something that's culturally insensitive, perhaps even offensive to somebody, you're going to lose market. You're going to lose that audience. You're going to offend. We all know how quickly these things can escalate, and spread like wildfire through social media. The brand damage is huge, not just for that particular product. And so I think it's all about preserving your credibility, maintaining those relationships, making sure that anything you produce is right for that audience. I think the ramifications are enormous. And I think what we have to remember, I mean, there's with AI, we can do one of two things, right? We can see it as an enemy, or we can embrace it and harness it, not use it blindly, but harness it. And I think, you know, if we just trust that everything that it's producing blindly can go straight to production, we're putting ourselves at huge risk. So I think, you know, it's that layer of governance that we can add at various steps in the process is so key, because it's so hard to come back from brand damage or reputational damage or relationship damage once it's done.
And for the audience, I want to give you a brand damage example that happened here in Canada a few years ago during the World Cup. And one of the big brand in the country decided to use the word GOAT, which is the greatest of all time, and that's the abbreviation of it. And they printed a big billboard app, put it on one of the main highways, all the highways in the Quebec region and French-speaking province in the country. And they translated the word to what equal chevreuil, which is a goat, an actual goat, greatest of all time. So it's not, pay attention. Don't put it on a billboard. Revise it first.
It's one of those toe-curling moments, isn't it, where you think, oh, there, but for the grace of God.
And for people who are interested, you can actually Google this, and there's articles on it. The media picked it up, and it was publicly widely distributed. So you can find out more about it.
Wow.
At what point in the AI workflow do you think, Mel, do you actually intervene, or do you intervene all across the steps to detect or to pull out and correct these cultural issues before they ship out?
It's a good question. I think there's two areas to focus on. I think there's different kind of stakeholders responsible, actually. I think there's a responsibility and actions that can be taken on the developer side with input from the linguists. And then the second area, I think, is the governance area, which is something I'm increasingly interested in and I think is going to become key for us going forward. So I think, you know, if we look, and it is just the fact that the bulk of content that feeds into the AI engines is English source. So we've got a natural bias in there. It's biased more towards Western culture. It doesn't necessarily reflect Indigenous groups, less populated countries. It therefore, let's say, even if we had more weighting towards US English versus UK English, UK English is a little more formal, we're a little stiffer, we're very polite, and we wrap things up and hide the message in lots of words, whereas American English tends to be a little bit more direct, a little bit more promotional, a little bit more congratulatory, perhaps. So if you imagine that that's the training data, naturally the output is going to lean towards that. And so I think there's things that we can do at source. I think making sure that the data set is representative of the audience, and that might mean artificially intervening. It might mean removing some data, adding data that represents perhaps other territories, regions, languages, voices. Making sure that the prompts are clear. I think there's so much that we can do. We're talking here about how AI can potentially be damaging for CQ, but it can also be a tool we can use, right? It can do two very clever things. Two of the areas that I think AI is greatest at is detecting problems. So asking it, is what's being produced suitable for this particular audience, but also rewriting it. So asking it to, change the tone of voice, to change the formality and things like that. So I think, you know, making sure the prompts are right, again, that conversation with the customer, with us acting almost like as consultants. So to lock down, who is this intended for? What tone of voice do you want? Adding that into a style guide. These are all assets that can go in to the actual training. And then I think the sort of second connected to the governance is the feedback loop. So making sure that we've got this pipeline of feedback coming from the linguists, coming from the experts. That might even be people, Robin, that go beyond language people. It might be anthropologists, sociologists, even in really extreme cases. That feedback loop, so you can then retrain. So using what we're learning, using perhaps where the message isn't landing well, to feed back in and to make it more appropriate. So I think on the, I'll call it the developer side, but the kind of, again, it comes back down to getting it right at source. There's a lot we can do there. And at the other end is the governance. And I think we have to have guardrails in place. We have to have clear responsibility of decision makers, where we have gateways that says, okay, going to use humans, sorry to say humans are definitely a part of this, use humans to give us some evaluation. We're going to test the output, even test it to try and break it, try and push it to edge cases, try and kind of push for it to cause offense so you can see, is there actually a risk of this? Test, evaluate, take that feedback and that input from those individuals. But ultimately, somebody's got to have decision-making power that says, okay, the risk here is minimal. I'm going to go ahead and publish. Or conversely, stop. This shouldn't be published as it is. We need to go back to source. So I think, as I say, and I think they need to work in partnership. And it's not, we're never done with cultural intelligence, right? It's going to change. Our, you know, history and relationships and power dynamics and all of these things will come into play. If you use a data set that's perhaps outdated, you're going to have something that might have been culturally acceptable a decade ago, but now isn't. And so it's, you know, like language is constantly evolving, so is this theme. So it's going to be a partnership. It's going to be people working together, having that feedback loop, consulting the experts, recognizing that it goes beyond the words and the language and speaks more to the emotions and the responses and how something lands. But that's the good news, right? There is something we can do about this. This isn't a lost cause. We can actually harness it and get AI to help us further along that route.
You know, it sounds to me like, Mel, I don't know if you agree with this, that the large language models are the issue because they were developed with large language models. That's what the name stands for. Large data sets, highly encompassing, inclusive of everything, every topic, every scenario, everything humanity ever did. And you're right about the you know, the bias toward the English language, because that's the main language that get fed to these models. I think I did a couple of podcasts on this show about the rise of SLM, the small language models. And it sounds to me that this is where SLM is rising fast in the language industry. Instead of taking a specific topic and try to customize a large machine to fit the specific topic that we're trying to address as a language industry, I think dealing with a small language model that it's, you know, you mentioned governance earlier, that runs on your systems, in your network, not outside, highly customizable. You can feed it any information you want. You can get the reaction you want without any pollution, data pollution from the outside. It sounds like to me this is where you're heading. What do you think of that?
I agree. I think that's exactly it, isn't it? You know, you can go for the generic model, the one size fits all, but what happens when it doesn't fit? So if you want to have, you know, a quick off the shelf solution, lower cost, faster, fine. But if you actually want something that you know, is going to speak to that market, I agree with you. It's getting into those trained data sets. I mean, it's not, you know, I was talking about when I started translating. So this was largely pre-internet. So we had big fat dictionaries, right? We had your, you know, Collins German to English, and I did automotive for a while, so a Willidal, and you know, you had a tower of books. And back then, you were a specialist, because you couldn't afford physically, these things cost a fortune. You couldn't afford to have dictionaries in every subject matter. And so we were specialists. And then my view is, with the advent of the internet, we all became more generalists. You could find glossaries online and you could, you know, try your hand at doing a bit of legal translation. I think that's gone full circle with AI, both for the translators, but also for the language models of, we're now back to me, where linguists will add value going forward, and they absolutely will add value. I think they're more important than they ever were, but just in a different form and contributing differently, but is being those experts, helping guide, set things up correctly. But I think that's where they've come full circle of the linguists are back to being, or the people who will come out on top, being the experts, being the domain and subject matter experts. But the same with the language models, I agree with you, because that's where you're saving yourself downstream work. The better the output from the model, the less post-editing, corrective, the less retuning you've got to do. So yeah, I'm with you 100% there.
Now, for the audience, if you don't mind, Eclairos have something called Words Online Platform, and it's an AI-powered business management and language platform for faster time to market. That's what I was able to gather from what I got out of my research. Can you talk to us through a little bit about what the platform is and what it does and how it's helpful?
Sure. It's actually one of the reasons I joined Eclairos in the first place, actually, because it was doing what I'd only ever seen done once before, but on a smaller scale. So we use it as our main editing interface. Where it really helps us is with continuous localization. Now we get a lot of very small jobs through, sometimes one or two words per string. And because it's allowing us to, I don't want to put too much into the details, but because the translators can come in and pick the work rather than sending it and creating a purchase order, it's very fast. But the way in which it uses AI, right from the beginning, it uses AI to take quality data as well as data on availability and rates, and to match the right resource to the job so that we're not clogging up humans with phoning people or emailing, are you free? It then uses AI throughout the post-edit, translation, revision process as well to steer, to prompt and to guide, to raise flags, to, you know, if we were doing reduced revision, to send the at-risk segments to revision there. And then it uses AI as a downstream tool as well to do kind of AI quality evaluation and quality assurance. So still, I'm trying to get away from human in the loop, it's human at the core, whatever. There were humans involved at steps in the way, but AI is doing the heavy lifting throughout the whole process. Within the tool, we actually manage the workflow. So my guys are working in there, my guys who are overseeing production, they've got dashboards, they can see where we're at with things, they can monitor quality live, they can pull out the KPIs and the stats. So what I like about it, it gives us in production, one of the things that used to scare me is you only knew about an issue afterwards and the damage had then been done. This allows us to see quality live, on-time delivery live. So we're really sitting in control. It's kind of like being a pilot with a huge dashboard that's giving you all the answers. And it lets us then focus our energies on where they're going to be best spent and change the course best.
And everybody have access to this, your customers? And your internal staff or just your internal staff?
So we internally, we oversee the production. Obviously, the linguists are working in there. There is a customer interface. We have some customers who have their in-country reviewers who actually work in the tool as well and do their review in there so that we're all working in the same system.
And I like how you've gotten like your AI and various technology embedded at various steps and the human as well. The professional translators are in. And we talk a lot about value, and it's a frightening time for most of our linguists in the industry. And I'm sure your linguist probably asking the same question. I did a workshop in Saudi Arabia 2 years ago, and you know it was fascinating. 250 young graduates from university studying linguistic degrees in Riyadh, and they were asking, all of them, they're asking the same question. You know, should I keep my studying? Should I graduate? Is AI going to replace me down the road? And you know, it's scary and it's hard to convince people that technology will not replace you in the current form where you're operating right now, how you're operating right now. But you're right. You're absolutely correct. If we take the tool that being provided to us through technology and learn a way to work with those tools and add value using these tools, this is where it's going to be a differentiator and worth really taking a look at where is the professional translator. And just for the audience, it's just, I love professional translators and Mel is one of them, but I'm sure she can attest to the fact that translators make errors too, unfortunately, but yeah, they call sure. It errors. They make errors and nobody's immune from making errors, but that value they bring in, that sense, that human encapsulation of a human emotion, cultural sensitivity, we have not yet been able to transfer this into a mathematical formula, put it into a technology and get it to think and feel like a human. Not yet. There's a way to go. Still ways to go, but we're not there yet. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you this obvious question, I guess, for everybody. Where do you assess right now the knowledge or the education on AI in our language industry? How do you assess that? Do you think we're adequately educated about AI, or do you think there's still some education lacking?
I think it would be a great one for a kind of round table at a dinner party, depending on people's backgrounds. If I were to really generalize, I think customers are very trusting of it because, hey, it's going to get you your stuff faster and cheaper. So why wouldn't you embrace it? I think the other end of the dining room table, the other end of the scale, is the linguists who, and of course, we're all going to defend our craft, right? You know, I always think language is a passion and a craft. So we want to make sure that that's respected and kind of honored. So they're the other end of the scale. No, it's dangerous. There's a happy medium on everything. As I say, I think it's about harnessing AI. I think if we can, and I mean, as a linguistic community, kind of say, okay, look, some parts of language and linguistics isn't the most exciting. So let AI take care of that bit. Let it kind of do the hard work. And we come in then as the experts and do the polishing, the ensuring it's set up right. So kind of this whole consultancy approach. I see a huge future in governance. I think this is going to be really, really key. As I say, making sure that the material is adapted correctly for the market. And I think that's, you're completely right that you use the word feel. AI can't feel. It can do what we tell it. If we're driving the car, we're in charge of the controls and the steering wheel. It's going to go where we tell it to go. So if we get it right through prompting, by involving the linguists early on with source analysis, getting them to check that data sets are representative, there's involvement for the linguists there. And then it's the back end checking. So did it work? If it didn't, what do we need to do to course correct? And I think if we can go into it with the mindset of nobody expecting it to be perfect, but also not expecting it to be completely wrong, and just have that open mind and look at what the opportunities are for linguists, because as I say, I think they're going to become more and more and more important. And unfortunately, there'll be fewer of them as well. You know, definitely fewer people are pursuing languages through university studies. So the people who are willing and excited about embracing it, you know, there's a couple of people in my team who are constantly prompting and coming up with scripts and ways in which AI can do some of the stuff like terminology extraction and, you know, all of the heavy lifting, so that they're then there and free when I need them to come in and consult with a customer, when we're going to look at a customer moving into a new market and I need them almost as a cultural consultant, if you like. So that's where I think the human element will become more and more important. So I think we're two camps at the moment, and we need to all come together and meet in one in the middle and take the best of AI and learn to harness and improve the areas where, by its very nature, it's always going to fall a little bit short. I think that's a really exciting part in our history, actually. I think it's really exciting if we can not be scared, but open our minds to it and see, how do I add that unique value that means that I am not only relevant, but more important than I ever was. I think it's a great juncture to be at. But you've got to, I think, just have eyes open, a dose of reality, and be prepared to speak up and to raise the concerns whilst also seeing the opportunities, really.
Absolutely. And you know what? One of the things I'm noticing is turning people into an army of one. You know, they're able to increase their output tremendously. And there's no more, I'm one of those affected by this. There's no more death by spreadsheets and MS Word files. I recently gave AI access to my desktop, and it's amazing how much it cut down the amount of work I do by just analyzing the thousands of files that exist on my hard drive and give me answers. It's crazy when you use it in the right way, but also put the appropriate checks and balances in place.
Exactly.
So you don't end up, you know, publishing something or sending something to somebody and look like a fool because you sent the wrong information or the bad information. You don't want to do that. Now, for those individuals listening to us and not necessarily from our industry, the prospect customers, and there's a lot, many of the audience to this channel are not necessarily from the industry, from outside the industry looking in. They want to perhaps in evaluating, embedding cultural awareness into their AI workflow today. Where do they actually begin, in your opinion? Where should they start, in your advice?
I would start, if it were me, with really thinking about what do I want this product or this service to evoke in somebody? What is my goal here? What do I want to achieve? And that wouldn't be something just as simple as I want big sales, but is there a particular market you're after? Is there a demographic you're after? Is there an area that's weaker? What's the future plans with it? And then from that, really think about the audience. And I don't think it's fair to expect a customer to have, I think they will have the answers of what do they want to achieve? Clearly, what's the goal with this? But I don't think it's fair for them to think about what are the implications? What are the elements I need to think about? Maybe listening to us started to get people thinking, oh, gosh, I never thought about that. I never thought about the tone of voice, or I never thought about the level of directness or low context, high context languages. You know, it's language is a very complex beast. So I wouldn't expect, that would be unfair for them to have all the answers. But I think if they can start to think about what might happen if this, if I got it wrong, and what might be the implications. And then I guess it is, and this is where the linguists, the linguist community, the LSPs, et cetera, come into their fore, is reaching out and finding people who can guide on that journey, who can steer on that. So, but I think it's, you know, it's, we've all got to be budget conscious. We've got to be turnaround conscious. So it's also, I guess, an ask for customers is going to be, think about your risk management. You know, this is all, CQ is going to become part of our governance and our risk management strategy. Is the content that I actually just have at scale that I can't afford to do anything more with, that's just going to have to be a one-stop shop, versus almost tranching it up, using that dial to say, on this one, I'm happy to take a bigger risk because actually the cost is going to be too high otherwise, and the risk is quite low, versus the other end of the scale on your copywriting. Okay, this one I want cultural consultants on. And, you know, that may be somebody being in country. It may not be sufficient to be a speaker of Japanese. It may be that you need to be there to know, actually, and it's an alarm bell here that you should be aware of in that image or in that color or in that metaphor that you're going to use, whatever that might be. So it sounds a little cringy, but it's about partnership. It's about taking what you know as a customer, what the language experts know, and really coming together and partnering on that going forward.
Basically, what you're saying is make cultural intelligence part of your business, not an added service that you buy once in a while when you feel like it. Make it part of your process. Make it part of your business development process and your business plan.
And maybe to answer your question, Robin, maybe it starts with just being aware. Maybe this has helped folk just be conscious that there even is such a thing as cultural intelligence, right? Maybe people haven't known the term or haven't really stopped to think about what the impact is. So it probably starts there, being aware of what the repercussions can be, but also, you know, how you then can enhance it and embrace it for your benefit, right?
100%. I mean, you just reminded me, I had a conversation, when was that? A few months ago now, with a manufacturer here in the country, and that manufacturer ships their product to, I don't know, 20, 30 countries. And I was asking him, I said, like, there's manuals that goes with these products, technologies, whatever you're selling. And there's probably a website that your customers are coming onto your website, try to find out more about your product, whatever you're doing. And he said, no, we do everything in English. I said, are you kidding? He said, no, we do everything in English. I said, you sell to like over, you know, 20 countries and everything is English. So yeah, nobody asked us to translate. I mean, we don't have to. And he's just putting the case together why they shouldn't even accommodate the other cultures. Meanwhile, the other cultures are buying from them and they're spending their money with them. I won't name any names right now, but there are still the thinking out there. And I know it has an expiry date, these statements that these individuals make, they have an expiry date on them, because eventually they're going to have to go into a place where you have to accommodate the other languages, and you have to do things in multiple languages for your customers.
Yeah.
Today, and this is the thing too. Like, people think my product, they can buy from me and they can't buy from anyone else. Well, that's a large statement that nobody can live to that, because your competitor can come up tomorrow and say, oh, the other guys are not translating, I'm going to translate for you.
Absolutely. And then as the consumer, you're thinking, this guy cares about me. He's gone to the effort of putting it in my language, thinking about my culture, changing the imagery so that it works for me and makes sense. I know who I'd be going with, right?
100%. Now, let's talk a little bit, and we're coming to the end here. I got a few closing ideas for you, if you don't mind. Mel, 5 years from now, is cultural intelligence a department, a tool, a mindset, or all three?
Oh, gosh, that's something I hadn't thought of.
I would think probably more of a department.
It's all three. Well, I don't know, but I think it... Can we get away from it being a mindset? Because if you're not conscious of it, you're not even going to look to somebody to help you on that. I think it's a whole field in its own right. I genuinely do. And I think governance is going to be the area where we really see a kind of surge in demand and need, and as I say, a great opportunity for linguists and for the companies that embrace that. Tricky one. I think it's going to be so important and intrinsic to everything we do. I think I'll stick with my all three.
All three? Yeah, all three is more, I can see perhaps a cultural intelligence department within the marketing department that handles all three functions. You know, the mindset of the company, the drive, the culture, etc. But somebody somewhere needs to, you can't keep it spread across, but you need some central governance in place, and maybe a department that handles all the three tools, the mindset, the culture, the training, etc. So
there will need to be, decision owners, right? There's going to be need to be somebody, as I say, that makes that call on what's acceptable, what's not, what do we let go through, what goes back to redesign? What do we say, actually, sorry, that's not right in the state, versus what stops completely? And the problem is with anything like that, if the responsibility is too spread, decisions slip or don't get made. So yeah, I'm open to the argument of departments, because I'm a great fan of ownership. If you've not got ownership, then everybody's busy looking at their
shoes. We're not going to get anywhere, right, Mel? another one for you. What is the one thing you wish CMOs, chief marketing officers for the audience, understood about CQ before they signed off on a global campaign?
Just the impact from getting it wrong that you just can't undo. Don't underestimate this. This isn't something you and I and anybody else has cooked up as another angle or as another revenue stream, another service we can offer. It's very real. As I say, the fact that from that training 20 odd years ago, the thing that stuck in my mind was that localizing an image, a cartoony image, it matters. It really matters. It's speaking to, if you're selling, you want to win over hearts, right? And if you get it wrong in the message and don't appeal to that person, it's not going to land.
And I've got a couple of more rapid fire ones. Best market you ever localized for?
I would go... I couldn't choose China or Asia. Sorry, China or Japan. I would go Japan, I think, just because of the difference between high context, low context languages, the difference of tone of voice. There's so much richness and complexity and so much to address there. So, yeah.
Here's another one for you. What is the biggest cultural surprise you've had?
Don't laugh. It was when I moved to Germany and finding out that the shops were only open till noon on a Saturday. I was a big shopper back then. I was a complete fashionista, and I was distraught when I discovered that working Monday to Friday, I had this tiny window to rush around the shops. But you know what I thought was, isn't this great? Because my first question is, why? You've got an opportunity to get extra revenue in. And what I loved was this massive cultural shift. It's like, no, that's your time you spend with your family Saturday afternoon and Sunday. If the shops are open, you're distracted. So it was a shock. Took a lot of getting used to. I'd be the person at 5 to 12 going, supermarket shuts, we've no food for the weekend. But I loved that there was just this different cultural emphasis, that family was really important and came above commerce and profits and revenue. That was my biggest shock ever.
And the one tool you cannot run your workflow without. That's the last one.
People. I'm going to say people. And that's the unfortunate thing. I think that now everybody's blinded by what AI can do and pushed to cut costs and pushed to do everything faster. Sadly, what's getting cut out of that workflow chain is the human. And I think they still have the biggest part to pay to stop us tripping ourselves up. So I will never stop advocating for human at the core, but just people. People harnessing technology, using it to their advantage, but people.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, Mel. Any other idea that you wanted to share, but we did not have a chance to share yet?
I don't think so. I'm sure I'm going to do that thing 5 minutes after. I'm like, I really wanted to make that point, but it's been great. It's been super nice having a dialogue, getting your view as well. Really enjoyed it. It's a fascinating subject. Hopefully folk listening find it equally. I could talk for a lot longer, but hopefully they find it as interesting as you and I clearly did.
I want to thank you so much, Mel, for joining me. I really appreciate your time. And thanks for being such a good guest on this channel. I really enjoyed the conversation. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. We could have gone a lot longer. Unfortunately, for the sake of time, we have to cut it at 1 hour, but we could do 2 hours, no problem. But you're welcome back to the channel anytime you want.
Would love to. Let's
consider
it
your own. Drop by anytime with an update. Would love to have you.
Great.
And thanks again. I want to thank the audience for joining us on this journey of this recording. If you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on the audio podcast, thanks for listening in. And if you are checking out our blog where I summarize these conversations on our blog site, abinayoub.blog, thanks for checking the blog out. We don't have to listen probably to 1 hour conversation. You can get a 2-3 minute read and you can get a summary of the conversation. Thanks for subscribing to that blog. I know a lot of you are subscribing to the blog, so thanks a lot for that one as well. And I will see you guys at the next episode. Until then, stay well. Thanks, everybody.